Well, thank you. Good morning. I can tell you're very time-efficient people. There was like nobody here 5 minutes before the service, and then boom! That was amazing. I got to take whatever time management class you all are taking. I need to take. Thank you, Pastor Kenny, for the invite. I see many familiar faces from our recent trip to Israel together, and here we're going to do it again in 2020. I encourage you to go. Don't think of it as a vacation. Think of it as an investment. It really is an investment. And as Pastor Kenny said, you'll never read your Bibles the same afterwards. And yes, my special connection, which I don't have time to go into much, but years and years ago, myself and a friend got the bright idea that we were going to cross the island of New Guinea without the use of motors. It took us 102 days. We estimated we could cross the Central Mountains in 14 days. It took us 56 days. Anyways, very long story short, when we did 100 miles on the coast and several hundred miles upriver, right before we went into the Central Mountains, we came to a village, and there were Jay and Lisa Francevic there. And so we got to know them then and have kept in contact since then. And so it's great to be in the church that sent them out. Thank you for sending them out. They blessed us. I developed a saying from our trip across New Guinea. It is, ignorance can get you into things that only God can get you out of. And that sums up our trip. So what I want to do this morning is, as an archaeologist, I want to look at one archaeological discovery. And then we're going to use the Bible to draw out the meaning of that discovery and its significance and its profoundness, okay? So that's what biblical archaeology does. We'll look at archaeological discovery, then we'll understand it through the Bible. The archaeology that I want to go over this morning was found way back in the 1950s in excavations at a site called Solib. And in ancient times, this was part of the kingdom of Egypt. But today it's part of the country of Sudan. And so back in the 1950s, they were excavating at Solib, and in particular, they were excavating a large temple there that had been built by a pharaoh named Amenhotep III. And this was covered with inscriptions, and one of these inscriptions mentions the name of the God of Israel, Yahweh. Now, I want to emphasize that over the course of archaeology, over almost 200 years, there have been many, many, many inscriptions found mentioning the name of the God of Israel, Yahweh. But this one at Solib is of particular importance because it is the oldest. Okay? And so I just want to go over just a few things with you before we start looking at this particular discovery, and that is, let's talk about the name Yahweh before we go into it here. The name Yahweh, you might have heard it called the Tetragrammaton. Don't let that throw you. That's just Greek for four letters, because this the name of God appears in Hebrew, it's four letters, Hebrew letters, Yod, He, Wow, He. And so as English readers of the Bible, we can be very disconnected from the name Yahweh. And this is because of an old ancient tradition, Jewish tradition, that the name of God is too sacred to pronounce. And so when a Hebrew reader reads the name of God, they don't pronounce it as they're reading it, Yahweh. They say instead of the name, the title Adonai, the Lord. And so in honoring this tradition, most translations into English translate the name Yahweh as Lord, only all in capital letters, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. When you see that in your English Bible, that's the indication that in the Hebrew, the name Yahweh appears. Now, Yahweh, the name Yahweh, is found in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, 6,823 times. Very, very important. And so that we have an inscription, all these inscriptions that mention this name, is extremely important. So I want to go over with you how I learned about this inscription. I was reading a book by a secular archaeologist scholar named Donald Redford, a well-known book, and I was reading along, and I want to read that quote that I read. This is what I read in his book. He's talking here, writing about this inscription found at Soleb, and keep in mind, he's a secular scholar writing to other secular scholars. When I say secular, I mean they don't believe in God, they don't believe in miracles, they don't believe in the supernatural. So I'm sitting there, I'm reading along, and all of a sudden I read, for half a century it has been generally admitted that we have here the Tetragrammaton, the name of the Israelite God, Yahweh. And if this be the case, now listen to what he says, as it undoubtedly is, the passage constitutes a most precious indication of the whereabouts during, here's the date for this inscription, the late 15th century BC of the enclave revering this God. Okay, so I want to stress this morning, I'm not here talking about archaeological discovery that I discovered, that's a mystery to everybody, and that I only know about it. Right? This is a discovery made way back in the 1950s that everybody is admitting to, that we have here the name Yahweh. How certain is it that this inscription says Yahweh? Undoubtedly so. I'm not the one assigning a date to this inscription. This is the inscription has been dated to the end of the 15th century BC, and that is held through time. I'm not going to give you my translation of what this inscription says. I'm going to give you the translation that it's been translated many times, and all the translations say the same thing. It's that clear. Okay? And so when I read this, I was living in Jerusalem, and I was like, wow, I mean, I've been studying archaeology in Jerusalem in the university for 10 years. Nobody ever taught me this. Because so often when we have evidence like this, it's swept under the carpet so that you can keep on saying there's no evidence for the Bible, which only works if you are sweeping evidence under the carpet. But anyway, so what I did is I ran to the library and looked up the excavation reports for Soleb. And so here is the temple that I was telling you about that was built by Amenhotep III. This is an aerial photograph from the 1950s. This inscription we're talking about is on this pillar right here. Okay, and so this is in the excavation report, the inscription. Now, I don't want to get too technical, but this is in Egyptian hieroglyphics, so let's just go over a little bit of Egyptian hieroglyphics. This slash that you see up here is the hieroglyph that simply means land. Okay, then the rest of these hieroglyphs that you see carry a phonetic sound like a letter. Okay, and so these next three that you see right here, they sound out the word Shazu, which is then translated nomads. Okay, so land of the nomads. And then you have four hieroglyphs. And the two feathers that you see here, that's the Y sound. Over here is the house hieroglyph, which is the H. The noose, which is the W. And then this bird is the way, W-E. So together, this sounds out the name Yahweh. Land of the nomads of Yahweh from the 15th century BC. Now, all we got to do is go to the Bible and to the chronology in the Bible. What's going on in the late 15th century BC in the Bible is that the wilderness wanderings under Moses are coming to an end. Are you kidding me? We have an inscription mentioning the name of the God of Israel, Yahweh, from the end of the wilderness wanderings under Moses? That's amazing. And by the way, what establishes facts more than anything else is the discovery of inscriptions. So take away the Bible. And what do we know? What are the facts that this single inscription being found establishes? We know, as a fact, based only on this inscription, that at least by the end of the 15th century BC, there is a group of nomads wandering around who are worshiping a god named Yahweh. What does the Bible say? What better way for the Pharaoh, Amenhotep III, to describe the Israel than the nomads wandering around who the Bible describes are following Yahweh in a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day? And so we have this amazing inscription, and I said to myself, okay, this I got to see for myself. And the problem is I have Israel all over my passport, and Sudan is a Muslim country, and you can't go to Sudan if you've been to Israel. So I go to the American Embassy in Jerusalem, and I get a second passport. Now I got, for the first time in my life, two passports. I very much feel like a spy, but I don't really know how to use two passports. So I leave Israel on my old passport, and I come into Jordan, and I go to the airport to fly to Sudan, and I give my brand new passport to the passport control guy in Jordan. And he looks at my passport. Of course, there's no entry stamps, no exit stamps. It's completely blank. I've appeared out of thin air. He looks through it like this, and he goes, "Give me your other passport." And so, you know, reluctantly, I give him my other passport. He's looking through, and it's just one Israel stamp after another. And so after he looks it over, he says to me, so what you're trying to do is you're trying to travel to Sudan and hide the fact that you live in Israel. And I said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. He said, okay, boom, and he stamped my passport. And so off to Sudan I went, was able to hire a four-wheel drive vehicle and a local driver, because this trip was going to be both on and off-road. So here we go across the Sahara Desert and crossing the Nile River on a local ferry, arriving on the other side and camping out along the way. So this was my sleeping quarters. Extremely hot in the Sahara Desert, by the way. And this has nothing to do with anything really. But look at the size of this spider. This is a camel spider. It's the size of my open hand. Okay? And look at the fangs on that thing. And look at where I'm sleeping. I'm sleeping down on the ground with these camel spiders and scorpions running around. Anyways, this was no vacation. This was an expedition. My definition for an expedition is as long as you're miserable 95% of the time, that's an expedition. After three full days, I finally make my destination. This Amenhotep III temple at Solub. And so this is the room here where Amenhotep III lists out all of his foreign enemies. And here it is again from the 1950s aerial photograph. It's this room right here, is this room right here. Okay, and it's divided in half here. This is he lists out his southern enemies on this side of this room and his northern enemies on this side. So I'll show you just a few examples. Here's examples of how he lists out his enemies. They're depicted by a prisoner of war with their arms bound behind their back. And then this shield-like inscription called a cartouche is what he identifies each of his foreign enemies. You can see these southern enemies are very African in their ethnicity. And then when we move to the northern side, you see that you start getting the beards. See that? And they're more Semitic. Then he identifies each one with these inscriptions. And if they're a nation, then he identifies them as a nation, like, for example, Libya. Or this hieroglyph that you see right here is the hieroglyph for city-state. So he identifies them from the city that they come from. And when we're reading all these cities in our Bible, many of those cities are found in this list. And for example, Megiddo or Ashkelon are among this list. And so then I come to the inscription that I've traveled so far to see, which freaks me out because you can see right across the top here, you see how it's all white scratched there? Some local had scratched out the top of this inscription and written their name in Arabic over the top of it. I mean, literally, this should be a focal display in one of the world's premier museums, and it's just sitting out here in the middle of nowhere with people scribbling their names across the top of it. When you're there in real life, you can still see the land of the nomads, but it is damaged. But the name, Yahweh, you can see the two feathers right here, the house and the noose. And the bird, that's the bird's head right there, and the feet down here. And so as they drew it out in 1950, the name is still preserved there to today. And so I spent almost a week at this inscription. Okay, so we have land of the nomads of Yahweh. And now if we want to really start to understand the significance of this name... And then why not go to the word of Yahweh to understand this inscription in the name Yahweh? Why not go to the text that mentions the name Yahweh 6,823 times? And a great place to start is Exodus chapter 3. And Exodus chapter 3 is the account of the burning bush. God is appearing to Moses. He's commissioning him to go and speak to the Israelites because Yahweh is about to he's about to free the Israelites from their slavery. And so in this account, we have, it says this. It says Exodus 3, 13 through 15. It says, Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask him, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, 'I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you.' God also said to Moses, 'Say to the Israelites, Yahweh,'" see, there's Lord, all in capital letters. You see that? So that's the name Yahweh. So Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. What is his name forever? Yahweh, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. So that's why I don't have any problem standing up here saying Yahweh, 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 right? Because it says right there, this is the name that he is to be known for forever, from generation to generation. And so just a few things that we can learn about the name Yahweh from this verse is names in the Bible mean something, and God's name is no exception. The name Yahweh means, when God says his name, it means I am. It's like the to be verb in English. It shows existence. I am the existent one. So the name Yahweh means I am. Okay? And the other thing that I want to point out here is that what's going on here in Exodus 3 is that it has to do with identity. And if we just go back thinking about identity and we go back to this inscription, this is what's going on with Amenhotep III. He's listing out, he's identifying his foreign enemies. And he gets to these nomads, and how is he going to identify these nomads? You can't call them a nation because they're not yet a nation by the late 15th century BC. He can't identify them from the cities they live in, right? Because they don't live in cities. They're nomads. So how does Amenhotep III in this inscription identify these nomads? Not by the name Israel, the name they have as a people, but by a much more significant name than that. By the name of the God that they worship. Because the name of their God will be their identity. And we have this in the Bible. We see this over and over and over again. You know, most of the nations at this time believe in many gods, but they all have a main god. They have the most powerful god. The king of the gods is the main god that they worship, and they're known. Their identity is connected to that god. So if I was to say to you, if I'm reading the Bible and I'm reading about the god Moloch, I know that we're talking about Canaanites. Okay, if I'm reading the name of the god Chemosh, I know that's Moabites. Kos is Edomites. Ashur would be Assyrians. Amun would be Egyptians. Marduk would be Babylonians. What people are you thinking of when I say the name of the god Zeus? Yes, the Greeks. What if I say Jupiter? The Romans. See how this works? And so this is what Moses is getting at here. He's saying, okay, God, if you're going to free the Israelites, then we're going to have an identity crisis here, because right now their identity is as slaves in Egypt. If you free the Israelites and you make them, you make them your people, then what is your name? Because your name will be their identity. They will bear your name. So what is your name? And of course he says, my name is Yahweh, which means I am. And now comes the question, why is it important for God to be known by the name Yahweh forever, from generation to generation? And, you know, obviously, it's because God lives forever and ever from generation to generation. So why not call him by his name, right? But another way to think of it is this, is I like to think of it as there's going on in history this massive game of Survivor. Okay, you know the TV show Survivor, and at the end of each show, there's only one survivor, and everybody else gets snuffed out, right? And this is going on in history amongst the peoples and the nations and the cities and their gods. Who is the real God, and who are the false gods? The false gods over time are going to get snuffed out, and the real God over time is going to show himself to be the one true God. And if you really pay attention to this in the Bible, you'll see this over and over and over again. I want to just go through one example of this, and I want to use the Assyrians. The Assyrians were the first true empire. They were brutal, and they had, in the 8th century and 7th century BC, the most powerful army on earth by far. And they would end nations. Nations that have been around for a long time, the Assyrians made extinct. If you see the lists of the nations up to the Assyrian period and then the lists of nations afterwards, there's all these nations that are gone. And so for our example, we have the kingdom of Judah down in the south. The king at this time of the Assyrians is Hezekiah. And the Judeans, they worship the god Yahweh. And then north of them is the northern kingdom of Israel. And they have betrayed their worship of Yahweh, and they've set up these golden calves, and they worship Baal. And then north of them is the Arameans, the kingdom of Aram. And their king of the gods that they worship is Hadad. And then north of them is Assyria. And so here comes Assyria to attack and conquer and end these nations. And the question is simple. Who will survive? Whose gods are real? Whose gods can save? You know how false gods die? Here's how false gods die. The people who believe in those false gods, when it comes to their moment of crisis and they need help and they need to be saved, their gods can't save them because they're not real. And when the people die, so with them dies the belief in those false gods. And that's why all the names of these gods that have been worshipped through history, they just disappear over time. Okay, so here come the Assyrians to the north. They attack the Arameans first. They have a systematic way of how they end a nation. They come into Aram. They destroy every single fortified city in Aram down to the capital, which is Damascus. They lay it under siege. Can Hadad save his people? Can he save the Arameans? No. They break through the walls. They kill the royal family. Aram is wiped from history. Then they go and they attack the northern kingdom of Israel. They wipe out all the fortified cities of the northern kingdom of Israel down to the capital city, Samaria. Can these golden calves, can Baal save the people? No, they're not real. And so the walls at Samaria are breached. Northern kingdom of Israel becomes extinct. Not the Israelites, that's another story, but the northern kingdom of Israel is no more. Then in 701 BC, under the Assyrian king Sennacherib, Judah is attacked, and every single fortified city in Judah is conquered. It's taken down to the last two, Jerusalem, which is the capital, and the second most powerful city in Judah, which is Lachish. And as the Lachish is about to fall, then Sennacherib sends his general, sends a message to the people in Jerusalem through his general to basically say, "You're next." And the general comes up with his message from Sennacherib to the wall of Jerusalem. The people are sitting of Jerusalem are sitting on the wall, and he delivers this message. So I want to read this. We could read it in Isaiah. We could read it in 2 Chronicles. We're going to read it in 2 Kings 18. But I want you to keep in mind as we read this, this massive game of survivor going on amongst the gods and the nations. So Sennacherib says this to the people of Jerusalem: "Do not listen to Hezekiah, for he is misleading you when he says, 'Yahweh will deliver us.' Has the God," now listen to this question, "has the God of any nation ever delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria?" I guarantee you, everybody sitting on that wall that day knew the answer to that question was no. None. None have delivered. Now he gives some examples. Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Zephyrvaim, Hena, and Iva? What? We haven't even heard of these places, most of us, right? Much less who their gods were. Why? Because they were made extinct so long ago by the Assyrians that you just don't hear about them anymore. Now he gets a little closer to home. Have they rescued Samaria from my hand? No. The answer to all these questions is no. Now listen to what he says. Who of all the gods of these countries has been able to save his land from me? Let me ask you this. What good is a god if he can't save? He's worthless if he can't save. What god has been able to save? None of them. So this is what Sennacherib says. How then can Yahweh deliver Jerusalem from my hand? The Assyrian army had brought a perfect record to Jerusalem. Every single city that they had gone to put under siege and take, they had taken. So that's the threat. Hezekiah does the only thing that he can in face of the most powerful army in the world, right? This is what he does. And Hezekiah prayed. And Hezekiah prayed to Yahweh, "Give ear, Yahweh, and hear. Open your eyes, Yahweh, and see. Listen to the words Sennacherib has sent to ridicule the living God." Now listen to what he says. "It is true, Yahweh, that the Assyrian kings have laid waste these nations and their lands. They have thrown their gods into the fire and destroyed them. Here's why. For they were not gods, but only wood and stone fashioned by human hands." Now listen to this part of his prayer. "Now, Yahweh, our God, deliver us from his hand, so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone, Yahweh, are God." That's the prayer. Here's the response. "That night, the angel of Yahweh went out and put to death 185,000 in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies." See, that's salvation by grace through faith, right there. What did the people do to save themselves? All they did was pray. That's all they could do was pray. They were completely helpless. "Save us, Yahweh." And then what did they do? How did they get saved? They woke up in the morning and there were all the dead bodies. That's Yahweh's salvation. Now, I want you to think of this from my perspective. Here I am in the Sahara Desert looking. I spent almost a week at this temple and this inscription. And so here I am studying this inscription that says, "Nomads of Yahweh." And then afterwards, I return to my apartment in Jerusalem, which is right across the street from a synagogue. And I remember the first Saturday, the first Sabbath, that the Jews came back to worship in their synagogue, and thinking of that inscription and that and going, "Hey, the nomads of Yahweh and this inscription that's over 3,400 years old, here they are worshiping Yahweh, and they're these, what are Jews? They're the remnant of the nomads of Yahweh." Still meeting in their synagogue, not just in this one synagogue, but in Jerusalem and Israel and the world. How is that possible? to help put it in perspective, think of it this way. Find me a place on earth where the Philistines are still getting together and worshiping Dagon. Or the Canaanites. Where are the Canaanites worshiping Moloch? Or the Moabites, Chemosh? What happened to the Assyrians? Where do the Assyrians get together today and worship Ashur? Or the Babylonians, Marduk, or Zeus, or Jupiter? What happened to all these gods? They're all the losers of this massive game of survival. The people who believed in them perished because they were not real, and they could not save them in their moment of need. And when they went extinct, so too their worship of these false gods. What are the Jews still doing? Worshiping Yahweh. It's because God has saved them again and again and again and again. He didn't just save them from the Egyptians. He didn't just save them from Sennacherib and the Assyrians. He also saved them from the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar, from Haman and the Persians, and from the Seleucids and Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and again and again from the Romans and the Nazis, all the way to the reality that they're still here because their God is real and able to save. God has answered, Yahweh has answered Hezekiah's prayer again and again and again, so that all nations on earth will know that Yahweh alone is God and able to save. Now here is the question. How does Yahweh save? How does Yahweh save? And now we're starting to transition from the Old Testament into the New Testament. Okay? How does Yahweh save? Here's how Yahweh saves. Yahweh, the God of heaven and earth, comes down and becomes a man. He takes on a body of flesh and blood and offers himself the perfect sacrifice for sin to save mankind from sin. That's how Yahweh saves. The Hebrew name word for saves is Shua. You can say that after me. Shua. Okay? Yahweh Shua. Yahweh Shua means Yahweh saves. Yahweh Shua can be condensed to Yahweh Shua, Yeshua. What does Yeshua mean? Yahweh saves. Yeshua, then, in the New Testament, because that's in Greek, translated into Greek, is Jesus. And then translated into English, Jesus. If it's translated from the Hebrew directly, it's Joshua. The name Joshua and Jesus are the same name. One just comes straight from into English from the Hebrew, and the other one comes in from the New Testament Greek. Okay? How does Yahweh save? Through coming down and becoming a man named Yahweh saves. Yeshua. Jesus. It's correct to say Jesus. That's how we say it in English, translated from Greek. But what Jesus means is Yahweh saves. And we can see this. Look at Matthew 1:21, talking of Mary. It says, she will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. And in this case, it's the NIV footnote. You can look down there. It says, Jesus is a Greek form of Joshua, which means, there's Lord, all in capitals, Yahweh saves. So then if we just take the name, what the name means, and plug it back into the verse, it makes perfect sense. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Yahweh saves, because he will save his people from their sins. Not only that, but Jesus uses the name of God for himself. In John 8:58-59, it says, Jesus says, very truly, I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. At this, they picked up stones to stone him. Why are the Jews picking up stones to stone him? Because here is a man saying, I existed before Abraham was born, and he's using the name that God gives Moses when he says in Exodus 3, what is your name? He's using the name God gave him as the name of God for himself. He is saying, I am Yahweh in the flesh to save you from your sins. So when we look at this inscription and we have this name Yahweh, we're not just talking about the Old Testament. The name that we've talked about that dominates the Old Testament is Yahweh. The name that dominates the New Testament is Yahweh saves. Jesus. Okay, now, we can ask ourselves this question now in the New Testament. How do we know the real Messiah from all the false messiahs? Because there have been a lot of false messiahs. How do you know the difference? Well, you know it the same way as you know the real true God from the false gods in the Old Testament. Time will tell. Time will tell. And so the real Messiah will stand the test of time. The false messiahs will be snuffed out in this, again, massive game of Survivor. And we use the Assyrians as our one example in the Old Testament for how this works. Now we can use one example for the New Testament of how this works with the Messiah. And a good place to go is Acts chapter 5. In Acts chapter 5, this is after, of course, the death, burial, resurrection, ascension of Jesus. His disciples are going as apostles. They're spreading the gospel. They've gotten in trouble because of that. They've gotten arrested. They've been brought before the Jewish leadership, the Sanhedrin. They're on trial. What are we going to do with these guys? Are we going to kill them? Are we going to keep them in jail? What are we going to do? And we hear from this guy in Acts 5 named Gamaliel. So it says this, "But a Pharisee named Gamaliel addressed the Sanhedrin. Men of Israel, consider carefully what you intend to do to these men." Now he says this, "Some time ago, Theudas appeared, claiming to be somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him. Theudas proclaimed himself the Messiah, and about 400 followers followed him as the Messiah. Then what happened to Theudas? He was killed. What happened to his followers? All his followers were dispersed. What happened to his claim of being the Messiah? And it all came to nothing." See, that's what happens to false messiahs over time. It just all comes together. They're extinguished. Okay, he gives us another example now. He says, "After him, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt." So Judas the Galilean claimed to be the Messiah. And he also had followers follow him. What happened to Judas the Galilean? He too was killed. What happened to his followers? And all his followers were scattered. And again, with Judas the Galilean, just as with Theudas, it all came to nothing. It was extinguished when he was extinguished. Okay? And so then Gamaliel says, "Therefore, in the present case, I advise you." What is the present case? The present case is Jesus, who claimed to be the Messiah. These men that are on trial are followers of him as the Messiah. And so listen to what he says. He says, "Leave these men alone. Let them go. For if their purpose or activity is of human origin, like Theudas and Judas, it will fail. But if it is from God," in other words, if Jesus really is the Messiah, "you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourselves fighting against God." And then it says that his speech persuaded them, and they let them go. What are they saying? Oh, yeah, time will tell. Time will tell whether this Jesus is the real Messiah or just another one of these false messiahs like Theudas and Judas the Galilean. Now, here's what's intriguing to me, is if we just fast forward the clock from this test as it's set up, if we just fast forward the clock 40 years from the crucifixion of Jesus, we have an independent of the New Testament source about Jesus in Flavius Josephus. Josephus is a Roman historian. He's Jewish. He comes from the priestly line. And there's two paper trails for his quote on Jesus. They've compared these, and this is what the original said. And so, again, this is not, I'm not going to be reading from the New Testament. I'm reading from an independent source from the New Testament about Jesus just 40 years after Jesus' crucifixion. This is what Josephus has to say looking back. He says, "At this time, there was a wise man called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. Many people among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Jesus claimed to be the Messiah, and he had ones who followed him as a Messiah, many of them from both the Jews and the Gentiles. What happened to Jesus? Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. He was killed. But, that's a key word, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. Do you see the contrast between Jesus' followers and Theudas and Judas the Galilean? They're still following him. Why? They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. See, the followers of Jesus weren't following a dead Messiah. They were following a resurrected Messiah, a living Messiah who was able to save. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have reported wonders. This is Josephus writing this. Now listen to how he ends his quote about Jesus. He says this, "And the tribe of the Christians, so named after him, has not disappeared to this day." 40 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, the followers of Jesus as the Messiah are still following him. And Josephus is amazed by this. What would Gamaliel say if he would have seen this? That 40 years later, the followers of Jesus are still following him. He would have concluded, okay, Jesus withstood the test of time. He's the real Messiah. He's not like Theudas. He's not like Judas the Galilean. He's not like false messiahs that are extinguished over time. His followers keep following him because of the resurrection, which proves that he is the Messiah. Now think of this. What if Gamaliel and Josephus could see the tribe of Christians today, almost 2,000 years after Jesus was crucified? It would blow their minds. That not only has the tribe of Christians not disappeared to this day, but it fills the earth, and people like Jay and Lisa and all the people in those pictures and so many more continue to take the gospel message of who Jesus is to the remotest parts of the earth. See, we are sitting in this room today connected to this over 3,400-year-old inscription. Because the name on that 3,400-year-old inscription, Yahweh, that's who we're here today to worship. Yahweh and his son, Yahweh, saves. Why? Because he has saved us, which has everything to do with identity. Because once the Israelites were slaves to Egypt, but when God made them his people, they bore his name from then until today. And because we once were sinners, and that was our identity, slaves to sin, Yahweh came down and died for us to free us from slavery to sin. And now we have our personal names, but that's not what's the most significant. Now we bear his name in this world as his witnesses. His name is our identity, and we bear it in this world. Amen. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we are amazed.